Buenas and welcome to the Dear Gorgeous podcast. We're your hosts, Akina and Jelena, two Micronesian and Asian women from the beautiful island of Guangdong. And we're on a mission to share the stories of inspirational Asian and Pacific Islander women from around the world.
Hey guys, we have Cynthia Ng with us again. If you guys don't remember, she was one of our, I believe she was guest, gorgeous guest number two from early on in season one. She is a really good friend of mine from college. We went to acting school together and we all sort of are connected in a way that we all went to college in San Francisco, kind of at different times. No, Cynthia, I think in your original episode, we talked about how you were in Vietnam and how you were living there for a little bit, but moved there just because you wanted to get closer to where you were from, learn about the place that you were from because you grew up in Concord in the Bay Area in California. And now that part of your journey has sort of concluded itself. And you moved back home for a little bit, and now you are in New York. So you moved to New York the end of last year. And so Akina and I are just really curious to see how it's been going, see how you've been doing. And there are some things that are being discussed currently on the news that I feel like we would love to ask you about. So welcome, Cynthia.
Welcome.
Wow, that was one hell of an opening, Jelena. Wow, you just gave like basically an entire summary of my life.
Was it accurate?
That was quite accurate. Yes, so I was living in Vietnam the last time we recorded an episode. That was actually back in 2018. I moved back to California after Vietnam because I realized Vietnam just wasn't for me long term. And I stayed in California for about a year and I'm now here in New York.
What a move.
What I find really cool about your move to New York, what I've always found cool about you is that like you sort of have this idea of like, I kind of want to do this. It sounds fun. Okay, I'm going to do it. Like the next day you're just like, I'm on a plane to Vietnam, or like, and I say, like, I'm on a plane to Mexico. Cause, like, after you left to California, I was like, okay, I wonder what's next for this trip because I didn't think you were gonna be like staying at home for too long. And then I know you took like that, like, small little self. What am I trying to call it?
Yeah, so it was so funny because, I guess after being in California for like a year and then, I decided in less than a week to spontaneously book a trip to Mexico, specifically Tulum, because I figured why not? And it was just kind of a time for me to reset myself. I was supposed to be there only for 2 weeks. I ended up being there for almost a month. And during my time in Mexico, I was able to take a lot of time to myself. I meditated and it kind of brought the idea of moving to New York. While I was there. So it was just one of those moments like, okay, I'm in Mexico right now. I'm not feeling my happiest in California. I want to go somewhere else where I feel like I can thrive in. And I lived in New York for 3 months back, I would say, I think in 2013. I lived in New York for 3 months. I knew I loved it here in New York. And I always saw myself coming back here. I just didn't know when. And just during that time in Mexico, right before I moved to New York, was just kind of confirmed to me that, you know, New York is just kind of the right time right now. And here I am, girl.
And you met someone in Mexico, right? Like you met a person, got really close with them, and they were like, hey, like if you ever need a place to stay, like come on over, like, right? Is that how it went?
Yeah, it was really funny because actually while I was in Mexico and I kept meeting people in New York, like from New York, I don't know why there was an abundance of travelers coming from New York in Mexico at the time. I didn't even meet too many Californians, which was funny to me because California I think might be a little closer to Tulum, Mexico than to New York. So I guess in some ways that kind of confirmed to me that okay, like maybe I should go to New York. And I was really blessed and fortunate to meet like a couple of really good friends who came from New York, and I was able to connect with them when I moved here.
Nice.
It just shows you that you can meet friends anywhere and travel to anywhere in the world if you please.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, solo traveling is always super interesting. I know in our last episode, we talked a lot about cultural identity. And I think I do believe we talked a lot about your parents and your experience, you know, just with being first generation diaspora. And so I want to revisit that, especially right now, because of all the things that have been going on online and all of the, we're just seeing a lot of talk and video footage of violence against Asian Americans right now online. And, you know, that could be for several different reasons, but I think most people are saying that it's just because of what's going on with COVID, and this is not the first time Asian Americans have been sort of singled out.
No, yeah, this isn't the first time that Asian Americans have been singled out, like you said, in politics, even the media. I think we briefly talked about this in the several sessions that we had. We caught up, and especially for you and Jelena, who went to acting school, you know, and trying to penetrate that market. But I guess also coming from like an Asian American Pacific Islander myself, I feel like we're looking at this issue in two different lenses. You live in New York City. A lot of the videos that have been coming up are surprisingly from the Bay Area, where all three of us used to live and, you know, spent a lot of our youth. And for me personally, I felt very, very safe in San Francisco. So when I was seeing all these videos, I was like, whoa, what, how? Like, it just came all at once, and it was really hard to absorb, because the San Francisco that I knew was obviously a very, very different San Francisco and different America at the time. But you have to admit that these undertones of racism have always existed. But yeah, I'm kind of curious to like sit with you and see how this looks from your lens, you know, obviously living in one of the biggest cities in America. How's that experience been for you? And how have you been sitting with all of these things that have been coming up?
I think I can say that many of us feel affected by what's been going on in the States. Whether you're Asian, white, Black, children of immigrants, you know, it's really devastating to see what's been going on and just seeing someone being attacked just because of their race. And it's, I guess, right now it's just a really sensitive subject that we're going over. And it's been a little difficult to process it just because I've been witnessing so much anger and pain on social media. And just coming from like my perspective and just the way I grew up and seeing the things that I grew up in Concord, which is actually about 30 minutes away east of San Francisco, which is some parts of the city, it's dominantly Caucasian, and then the other part is dominantly Latino. And there weren't too many Asians growing up, or there weren't too many Asians where I was growing up, or it felt like we were separated, versus like going to like San Francisco and Oakland on the weekends with my parents and family to eat and to shop our groceries, just because that's where our community was. And I guess it's really hard to just see it all, because it really hits home, because I think people are really trying to figure out what to do right now and how to stand up to these causes. And it feels like, and I think a lot of people may say that it almost feels like a repeat of like last year with Black Lives Matter. And I don't want to be that person. I don't want to go and compare like our causes, because at the end of the day, to me, we're still fighting for the same cause. You know, we're still fighting the fact that we're oppressed, that we're getting attacked, and we just need to figure out how to coexist together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things that has been particularly painful to see are the videos where like our elderly are being harmed on the street. Like, I can't imagine just, you know, like my grandma, just like minding her own business, walking outside of Bingo or something, just something she probably would be doing. And just, you know, like, I think the fact that, because we, I mean, I think one of the things that we culturally have in common is that we respect our elders and we honor them. And and so, like, to picture that, or to imagine that something so violent could happen to them is almost unspeakable. And it's so dehumanizing to see. And it does really get you to question, like, what within the structure of our society is so broken that someone would think that it was okay to do that. I mean, violence in itself is terrible, and it is terrible, but it's like,
yeah, it has you.
Not my grandma, you know, like, what? Like,
and it's crazy because it's young people who are attacking these elders, like 30-year-olds, 20-year-olds, like, it's, yeah, it when makes, I saw those videos, I was like, what is,
like, what is going on? Like, it makes me wonder what is happening to them where they feel triggered and feel like it's okay to attack someone who is helpless, especially someone like elderly who may have, you know, a harder time fending for themselves, you know,
right.
And having to be attacked for like no reason, or even like process the idea, like, why did I get attacked and why do I have to get
because
attacked when I
look.
Was just, yeah. And it's, and just having them deal with that trauma. And I think it's really hard, especially if you're children of immigrants or come from an immigrant family and raised with maybe your cultural values. But I know a lot of Asians growing up, we were told or taught to like always look down, just never start an argument. Like if anyone gets angry or upset, just do as much as you can to diffuse it or just walk away from the situation, you know, like we just don't like confrontation, you know, and we don't like confrontation because we like to keep the peace. I think it's just becoming a lot more difficult to figure out how do you try to unite these people together, or how are you able to navigate around those triggers, or people feel like it's okay to divide to a group of people, you know what I mean?
I think it starts in the everyday rhetoric that people are surrounded by, you know, like we've talked about this so many times, Cynthia and I, relating it to our experience in acting school, and it's so funny because like as a person of color myself, I feel like I still grew up kind of ignorant to to just being aware that like certain beauty standards were being pushed on me that weren't necessarily for brown girls and stuff like that. So like I felt like I grew up in Vallejo, I felt like it was a pretty diverse place. I didn't feel like there was so much segregation either amongst the amongst the different ethnicities that reside in Vallejo. Particularly because I think Vallejo for a long time was more just working class, like everybody was sort of in the same class. So, and that says a lot, right? Money, like how money is funneled into the city and how that influences the way people relate to each other. But when we were in an acting school, like being taught that there's a certain character that you can play because of the way you look, because of how high your voice is, because of how big or small your eyes are, or something like that, like I do feel like there were like these star players within our classes, and a lot of them happened to be of the same demographic. They all happened to be white. I never questioned it until like afterwards.
Yeah, and it's so insane because I think it almost took years for me to really process what the environment was for me in acting school. I remember going to acting school and, you know, coming from these like white teachers who told me that you have to be comfortable being the supporting character, Cynthia. You cannot play the main character because that's not even available to you. There's not too many Asian American lead actors. Asian Americans aren't allowed to write films like this. There's not enough like Asian, like there's just literally being told that Asians just don't exist in the media, or the opportunities you want to exist in the media aren't going to be there for you because you're Asian, and you just have to get used to it. And you may really have to work 10 times harder, and you internalize it. And I know for a fact that I internalized it for a while because that hurt my self-esteem. And I remember putting myself in positions where, or applying or going to open calls where these positions fit me, yeah, because I'm lower status, you know, or, and also it was also revealed to me that's what the acting world was, is that they were kind of right that there wasn't too many opportunities for Asian Americans, because you're kind of going back to the lens that we grew up with. A lot of these directors that we worked with, or even screenwriters, they're telling stories from their own lens, and some of them from their own experiences and how they view the world. And I think they lack the understanding that, okay, like Asians could be the main character. You know, Asians can play like the boss and can play the villain. And I mean,
and do have more complex stories.
And have more complex stories. Like those stories exist. And it's really difficult to kind of tell those stories sometimes, or tell the stories that you want, when you're kind of in an environment where you're constantly told no and that you can't do it. And that almost in some ways affirms that reality for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What I think is really beautiful too, though, is now you'll see like on Netflix, Never Have I Ever, where you'll see,
yes,
which I felt like was a really cool, I know like a lot of Southeast Asian people were like, oh, but you know, I wish things were set this way, and da da da. And I think that's always gonna happen when it comes to making art for your own people or making art for yourself. But like, things are starting to happen where we are telling more complex stories about different people and different identities, which I think is great. But like, how do we, like, yeah, so there were years that I think you and I can relate in saying that we internalized the way we thought the world actually looked. And that is primarily telling white stories. And people like us fall under like more exotic, we're called exotic, and we're called exotic, mysterious, conniving. Like, we're never like the angels. Like, yeah, we're never like the good people,
we're submissive.
The good women. Yeah, we're submissive. We're, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, and the fact that we're talking about our experience in acting school, and this is just like a closed environment, like at university, in college, in our classrooms, but it does have you wonder and question, what about the classrooms in grade school? What about the work environments? What about the communities that we surround ourselves in? What about like the households that we grew up in? What about our friends? You know, like the restaurants that we go to, the cafes. And it just shows you how significant it is to have like diversity and have people be able to share these stories, enabled to kind of understand different experiences, you know, like, and when I think about our experience in college, it's just like, okay, if that was their experience in college where we were told that the world looked like this, again, you have to question, if that's happening in school, how else is that happening in other parts of my environment? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, what other parts of my environment have been shaped by this like invisible, like,
yeah, man. And it's like, and it's yeah, exactly. And it's almost having someone else be the narrator to our own stories.
Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because I started this manifestation program, and said that a lot of what's our, I guess, the foundations, our belief system, from the ages of 0 to 7, you just absorb everything that your caretakers tell you and teach you, including your environment. So that also includes your teachers. And you just kind of absorb that as what reality is supposed to look like. And that's what shapes the world that you live in, because these informations get processed in your subconscious. So if you're fed the wrong information or like skewed narratives after the age of 7, half of it is trying to break that down, we all know breaking down your limiting belief system is just like a really difficult thing to do. And it's just responsibility. It's a process. And having responsibility as an educator, and just, it's crazy how much of your environment could shape the way that you look at the world, even now at like 30.
Right. Yeah. And like those people who feel angry towards Asians or want to attack them, it has me wonder, okay, what kind of education are they receiving where they feel like that's okay? Like, what kind of environment are they surrounding themselves for that's validating that? And it really just shows you how important it is to, again, tell narratives, tell your stories, because it's the bridge to like familiarity. Because at the end of the day, I think a lot of us, or a lot of people, feel like we're so different, but at the end, we're actually a lot more similar than we think.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So do you feel like things have changed a little bit on the streets since all of this has become more? I have a friend that recently moved to Washington with her boyfriend. She was telling me recently that her boyfriend is kind of scared for her to go and like run errands and stuff by herself, just because he doesn't know if she's going to be safe, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if you felt that energy shift.
You know, this is probably me coming from a place of privilege. Because I was born and raised in the Bay Area, I didn't ever feel like I was concerned about my safety because of my racial identity. And I don't feel like that too much right now in New York, just because it is another, melting pot of cultures. But what I did forget to acknowledge was people who are worried for me. So it's funny talking about like my own safety and if I was ever concerned about it. I just never felt concerned, maybe because I'm very mindful of where I am. But even then, I think that's what a lot of people are. And but it's also kind of weird for me to have phone calls from my friends and even my boyfriend being concerned about my safety because of these like Asian attacks that they've seen in the media. And that's when I realized it's kind of shaped my like circumstance and opinion a little bit on the way Asians are being attacked. And it feels a little disheartening, because I don't want people around me that I care about to have to feel worried about my safety the same way I have to worry about them. And it does have me question, okay, like how do I navigate through that? You know what I mean?
So I do have a question for you, Sen. So you lived in Vietnam for a bit, and man, that whole journey, so inspirational. It got me thinking like how I want to spend some time living in Japan too, to kind of better understand like where my mom's from, where my grandma's from and stuff like that. So after living there for a while, has this shaped the lens that you see some of the issues as present today?
Yes, I do believe living in Vietnam and coming back here to the States has shaped my lenses. I think a lot of it had to do with my own conflicts of racial identity, because when I went to Vietnam, I wasn't seen as Vietnamese, I was seen as American. And, you know, when I'm here in the States, I'm seen as Asian, like I'm not American. So, and I had to question and wonder, like, why do I feel like I never fit in wherever I go? Why am I still identified as this person or that person? And why is there a narrative like over my head on like what my story is, because I'm American or I'm Asian? And it all came down to lack of education. And it, like, even being in Vietnam, I faced like discrimination and being told certain things because of my shape, size, because I was American, I was Vietnamese, born in America. So there's a lot of stories and narratives held behind that. And these were just stories that they were told from the media or from other friends on what like Americans look like what Americans are like in Vietnam or what Asians are like in America. These are just stories that are told to people or narratives that they've read somewhere and that they believe that it's true without really asking what that person's experience is. And it just doesn't make sense to me sometimes, where it feels like something like maybe me being called like fat or like being criticized for like my body or being an American in Vietnam. And if I were to tell someone that story, someone may just label that, okay, like Vietnamese people are just rude and say things like that and have a very narrow mind of thinking. And to me, that's a very isolated incident. I wouldn't label that as like, that's all Vietnamese people, because mm-hmm. there are also many people out there, no matter what race you are, that they are open-minded and are curious and want to learn about things, you know, or maybe they need that little like push or that crutch. And it all starts with education, you know, whether mm-hmm. it's in the classroom or even, you know, people learn about different cultures through like TV shows and movies. Like, representation is important there.
Yeah, 1000% agree. Yeah, it's so interesting too, because like mm-hmm. when I go to Japan, I walk into a McDonald's, I remember this so clearly. I walk into a McDonald's and they automatically like flip the menu to English.
Yeah.
And then just in spite of them, I flip it back and I just order my food in Japanese. And like, oh, you speak Japanese? And I'm just like, yes. And is when it, I was living in California,
like, I love that.
Physicality, like, is it just they just can tell by the way you carry yourself? Or like,
yeah, that's what my grandma was mentioning. She's like, so I remember when I was growing up, I was living or not living in Japan. When I would visit my grandma for months at a time, I would try my best to try to fit in by wearing all of the what was trendy in Japan at that moment. The problem was they don't have my size. Because I'm a little bit bigger than the average, you know, Asian size at the moment. But no matter how hard I try to fit in, like, I automatically stand out. But going back to what you were saying, Sin, like, when I'm in Japan, I'm labeled as American. When I was living in California, I was labeled as Asian. Even when I moved to Guam, I was labeled as Asian, even though I'm half Chamorro. So mm-hmm. I felt like this disconnect all around. Mm-hmm.
And it just shows you that these disconnects and these kind of oppressions and views of certain people not only exist in the US, but it exists in so many parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that I'm noticing is like a really common denominator, though, is this level of cultural, what I would call or refer to as cultural imperialism. So in the US, there's a specific culture that is being perpetuated, and if you don't fall under that culture, you don't speak English a certain way, if you don't look a certain way, if your hair is not a certain color, then you can't be as successful within the culture or within society as someone who does fall under those categories. And and yes, you can find that in different places of the world. And I think that this is what really connects us all, is that at least us three, right? Is that like here in Guam, it's very prominent here because we're still technically a territory of the United States. So are we American or are we not? What does it mean really to be American anyways? And I think that remembering that we still live in a climate where who we are, so like who our parents, like the identity that our parents passed on to us, and then the identity that's being pushed onto us from the outside world is still kind of in conflict because of that, you know? And that's something that's a very painful internal journey to walk, or internal path to walk, constantly fighting for, like, this is who I am, this is who I want to be, and I want to be accepted, right? So I think the more we talk about these things and the more we share our stories, the more we're able to realize that we're all sort of dealing with that same path in different ways. And I think it's just become way more apparent that we do need to share. We do need to to start building our own confidence around our identities and unapologetically sharing that there are more than one, there's more than one way to be. And that we also need to be more aware that there is a perpetuating of this one specific culture that we've been living with for our whole lives. And it's not, it doesn't have to necessarily be true. Akina and I had a pretty cool idea that we wanted to start. Akina, did you wanna kind of get into that?
Sure. So last year in 2020, we were invited to Inspire Guam conference. And we had this workshop where we had everyone kind of write a letter, and they could keep it anonymous if they wanted, and just really put your emotions and feelings or whatever you might be wanting to express onto paper, because we both really feel that writing is a form of healing. And after a workshop, everyone left with a letter from someone else. And the feedback that we got was so moving, because a lot of the responses was that, oh, I didn't know that this person was going through something similar. Or I actually had someone reach out to me about a experience that we shared together, and the universe conspired where she got my letter. And I think it's a beautiful way to remind people that our stories are very similar. And like what Jelena was saying, there's just a lot of parallelism. It's also through trauma. So we want to invite the community, our listeners, that until the month of May, you're more than welcome to send us a letter. And Cynthia, if you'd like to join us as well, and email us at info.deargorgeous@gmail.com. You could just email us your letter. At the end of the month, you'll be receiving a letter from someone else. And keep it completely anonymous. We won't disclose your name if you choose to. But just as a reminder that at the end, we also want to create a healing space and have DG be a platform where we could kind of process a lot of things that are going on internally, whatever that may be.
Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us again and offering your beautiful perspective.
Yeah,
I'm so grateful. Thank you so much. I can't believe it's been how long, like it's been years since we've seen each other, but thank God for Zoom.
thank you so much for having me again. It was such an honor to be, you know, on a podcast episode with you guys again. You know, it's always fun and it's always empowering to be here.
You're part of the DG fam. Always a space for you. All right, guys. So once again, our email is info.deargorgeous@gmail.com. Feel free to join our letter campaign that will go all the way through into May. And you can follow us on Instagram. Jelena, what are our social media handles?
Our social media handles are @DearGorgeousLetters on Instagram and Facebook. So feel free to reach out to us there too if that's easier. We look forward to hearing from you guys.
All right. Until next time. Bye, guys.